Thanks for listening to the Adam Carolla Show on Podcast One. Thanks for listening to the Adam Carolla Show on Podcast One.
Director, writer George Gallo is going to join us. News coming up after George.
Adam Carolla's I'm Your Emotional Support Animal, navigating our all-woke, no-joke culture, has over 1,000 five-star reviews on Amazon. Here's one.
Carolla always put out top-notch production, and this is certainly no exception. Definitely recommend the read.
Thanks, Ozzy. Pick up I'm Your Emotional Support Animal now. Available in all formats. For more, go to adamcarolla.com.
Well, writer, director, producer, painter, musician, raconteur. I just added that one. George Gallo is joining us. The Comeback Trail is the name of the movie. It's coming soon. The release got pushed back into somewhere in 2021 due to COVID. It's got De Niro's in it, Tommy Lee Jones, Morgan Freeman, Emile Hirsch, and a lot of recognizable and big-name stars. Good to see you, George.
Good to see you, Adam.
So what's the process of making a movie like this? And is it always what we suspect, that once you get Robert De Niro, it's easier to get Tommy Lee Jones and Morgan Freeman? Or are we way off on that?
No, you're absolutely 100% correct. The history of that project was I wrote the script several years ago with I have a writing partner on that one, Josh Posner. And we would give it to people and they would read it and they say, you know, it's one of the funniest things I've read in a long time, but this, we're just not interested in making it, you know, because of, you know, it doesn't check various boxes, you know, as if checking boxes is a guaranteed hit, you know.
Right.
The reason this happened was, Bob De Niro, I know very well from Midnight Run.
All right.
You know, we talk from time to time, and he called me out of the blue and he said, do you have anything funny? He says, because I just played a psychopath in The Irishman for 8 months and I've got to cleanse the palate, you know? And I was like, yeah, I do. I have this really left-handed script. He goes, well, send it to me. So I sent it to him. He called me back a couple of days later. He goes, this is great. I'd love to do this. So, and then suddenly, boom, after years of, you know, not being able to get it off the ground, we were shooting it within about 15 weeks after that.
Wow. I've never felt more satisfied in my life.
No, you're 100% right. And then Morgan Freeman, I already knew. So from another movie. So I called Morgan, and then Tommy Lee Jones. I think Bob had it. Well, Bob had a major hand in talking to Tommy Lee Jones about it, but yeah.
Tommy Lee Jones, I'm a fan of, and I don't heap praise on him enough, but my son was just telling me he watched over the weekend No Country for Old Men, and I thought, God damn, I love that movie. And
yeah,
then I realize how good Tommy Lee Jones is when you watch that movie, right?
He's brilliant. And that performance especially, it's just a very sort of internalized kind of performance, you know, and it's what he's not saying.
Yeah.
And all the subtext is what makes it so interesting, you know, that he kind of feels done and that he's finished and that, you know, it's a terrific, it's really a great film. And every time it's on, I go, all right, I'm just going to watch 10 minutes and turn it off. Yeah. And then I start watching the whole thing. I got to see this part. Then I got to see this part.
Yeah. And then you forget that, like, Woody Harrelson's in the movie. Like, oh, my God, he's so great.
Yeah, right. Yeah. And then he says, do you validate? Doesn't he say something like that? Do you validate after he
makes something like that? Yeah. Well, he says, I was in your elevator. You're missing a 13th floor. And Stephen Root perfectly goes, we'll look into it.
Yes, correct.
And now, you know, the brilliance of that movie, as I think about it, is Tommy Lee Jones's character is so internal, monologue-y, and sort of low key. And they hook him up with the young sheriff, young deputy, who's all id and he's all external, and he's bopping around going, oh, the milk is still cold. Yeah. It's yeah. when we just missed him. We just missed him. And Tommy Lee's just sitting there staring at his own reflection on the TV set. It's like such a great juxtaposition between the yeah. young Buck and the old
great actor. He was on our show. I just can't remember. It's not Walton Goggins. It's
yes. I always want to say that we got to look.
Looper. Yeah. I the guy's a great actor.
He said we should tell the like put on the air something, and he goes looking for a man who recently drunk milk or something. That
right. So we'll do 20 more minutes on No Country for Old Men, and then we'll briefly
talk about anything you want.
We'll briefly touch on the comeback trail, and then we'll wrap it up. Because that's the way that's the way we roll. So yeah, you get De Niro, and all of a sudden the dominoes start falling. So the movie was shot. I just watched the trailer. It's very funny, and it's a kind of L.A. 1974, I believe, which is just a perfect L.A. era. And I'm so, I mean, I guess after watching Tarantino's film. Hollywood Stories. Was it Once Upon a Time in Hollywood? Yeah, just it's so cool seeing Los Angeles, you know, back in the day. But the movie got pushed. What's the kind of COVID deal on it?
Yeah, it's because of COVID. It was supposed to come out in October, then they said Thanksgiving, then they said Christmas, and now I don't know when it's coming out. Who knows? But whenever they find a cure for COVID. I don't know. It's supposed to be on 3,500 screens. It's a big release. So,
but it is flattering in that they don't want to just do VOD on it, right? They want it in theaters.
Yeah. Well, it's definitely, just before all the shutdowns started, I had the opportunity to see it once. You know, you never really know because you make a comedy, you see it so many times. It's just not funny at some point to you. And because you just keep watching it and watching it. And so I did have the opportunity to see it in front of an audience, and they were hysterical. And so I figured, okay, it is funny. You know what I mean? So they want, I think it's the distributor sees it as a crowd pleaser. So, and I think hopefully after COVID, people want to go to the theater and laugh. I mean, the movie is funny. I mean, you know what the premise is about, right? It's,
yes.
Yeah, they're trying to kill Tommy Lee Jones for the insurance money. And so anyway, and they can't kill him. He just keeps surviving.
As I think back, we're talking before you hopped on and how much we love Midnight Run. And there was so much comedy in Midnight Run that people looked at it as, I don't know, buddy, thriller, action, whatever, road trip,
road movie. I think it was a buddy comedy first.
Yeah. But it just had, well, I guess we weren't used to seeing De Niro being as funny as he was in Midnight Run at that point. But that was a really funny movie.
Well, thank you. Thanks. Yeah. No, I'm very proud of that.
Yeah.
Seeing it as a kid, like a little kid, the only other time I'd ever seen Charles Grodin was in The Muppet Caper. So that was my only background to some of these actors because I was so young when I saw it, and it stuck with us all these decades.
Yeah, I saw it late as an adult, maybe like 6 years ago, whatever it was. And it was the perfect time to see it because all the jokes hit, and I think of it as a buddy comedy first. Of course, there's action elements and crime elements, et cetera. But the backbone of the movie, the way I would describe it to people and sell them on seeing it is it's funny. It's a funny movie.
Well, as I think about it, it had a lot of elements of one of my favorite movies when I was a kid, which is Richard Pryor and Gene Wilder in Silver Streak. It had a Silver Streak vibe to it.
Silver Streak's great. That's been on a lot, too, lately. I've been watching that, and Stir Crazy's been on. I've been doing the whole late 70s run, you know, because those are the movies I love. You know, I love The In-Laws, remember, with Peter Falk and Alan Arkin. Those are really the films I love watching.
Well, Serpentine.
So yeah, Serpentine. I was in the bush for a total of 9 months. Shall I saw things? I saw tsetse flies the size of eagles. You can imagine as I stood in my hut as horror as these enormous flies carried brown babies off to certain death. Natives had a name for them: Jose Grecos and Muertos, the flamenco dancers in death. What did you do about the flies? Unfortunately, there's very little I could do because they were covered under the provisions of the Guacamole Act of 1914. Obviously, I know The In-Laws. Yeah,
We should have said Serpentine.
Yes.
Right.
We should try to figure out Charles Grodin, because I have this vague recollection of being interviewed by Charles Grodin once when he like sat in for somebody. I think he sat in. Was there a Charles Grodin interview show like on CNN?
Like there was
in 2001 or something like that.
That sounds about right. Yeah.
And I remember him interviewing me, and he was like dismissive, and he made these sort of grunts like, okay, Adam, whatever. Like it was kind of funny, but it was also a bizarre way to conduct an interview. Is that who he is?
Yes. He has a big heart, you know, shockingly, you know, but, yeah, I mean, he did something to me that it's still, you know, like when you're a little kid and your parents do something kind of screwed up and, you know, you're 65 years, I'm 64. You know,
by the way, for my parents, it was getting married, but okay. Keep going.
Yeah. And like something like it'll resonate like 30, 40 years mm-hmm. later, for some reason, it'll come up. He did something to me that every once in a while I still think about. And because I was going out to dinner all the time with the cast. You know, I would go out with dinner with Bob. I'd go out with Yaphet Kotto. You know, I'd go out with, you know, the actors. And then I realized I'd never been out to dinner with Charles. So I said to Charles, I said, Chuck, hey, you know, we're stuck in this town here, but you want to go out to dinner tonight? He just went, with you? No. No. And I was like, is he kidding? Is he in character? It just kept going, no. And then he kind of smiled. And then he never said, I'm joking, which would be like the response that would follow that, right? You go, no, I'm effing around with you, you know? But no, he never did. I'm assuming he was. But anyway, that's my Charles Grodin story. But he was a very nice guy, you know?
He had this show, Chris, you got to hop on the computer. It was like 95 to 98. So it was
the
even
Charles Grodin show on CNBC.
What a name for it.
Yeah. It's weird that someone with that temperament would have an interview show. He did. It was kind of a Larry King type show. And I remember him just doing that same kind of deadpan thing with me, but he was like interviewing me. And I thought it was kind of funny, but I was also kind of curious. Like it was, you know, they were filming us. Like what? what if they were filming you, George, when he said he didn't want to go out to dinner with you?
Broke my heart. Yeah,
right.
You know, I was imagining him just now doing like a suicide prevention line. There'd be people jumping out windows. You know?
Oh, there'd be people who were on the balcony urging the person not to jump, who then would volunteer to jump with them as well. Is there any way, does that clip exist of me on Charles Grodin from 1997 or whatever the hell it is? But now, this is going to sound horrible.
Go ahead.
I have no idea if Charles Grodin is still alive.
Still alive.
Yeah, he was a few months ago, so I'm assuming, unless something happened.
And an interesting guy, like, how would you describe him as a performer? Not as a performer, but you'd go, he's a comedic actor, I guess. But I don't know if he wrote. I don't know all that is Charles Grodin. He was a very sort of, I'm sure everyone who taught him in high school was surprised that he went on to be a big comedic actor, right?
I don't know. I mean, he wrote a couple of books. I know that.
According to Wikipedia, he studied under Uta Hagen, very famous actor, acting teacher. So I wonder if this would have been in the, you know, 50s and 60s. So I wonder if he was a method or, you know, was approaching acting from a very different avenue as a lot of people.
He was at the time, I mean, very, very serious about what he was doing. And he really thought about everything he was doing. And because, you know, we did end up having quite a few creative discussions, you know, so he really did his homework as an actor.
Well, this is a kind of interesting subject, because I was just talking to someone recently where they said, I can't tell when you're kidding or not because you say everything in this very straight, deadpan way. And I'm like, well, of course I'm kidding. I'm saying something that's insane. And they're like, yeah, but the way you deliver it. And I was saying, well, that's what I'm supposed to do. That's how that's going. And I was thinking about this story we haven't talked about in a while. But when I took Teresa Strasser out and her fiance for dinner, my old news girl was getting married. So my wife and I said, well, we should take you guys out to celebrate your engagement. And we took them out to a nice restaurant. And when it came time to order, I said, of course, I'm paying for the meal. It's my treat. We're taking you guys out. But understand, my policy is that if you do get a doggy bag and order as much as you want and eat as much as you want, but as far as the food, it comes home with me because I'm paying for it and it'll prevent you from over ordering. Like you couldn't order a cheesecake and then just bring it home and eat it. So that's the policy. And with that in mind, enjoy. And I thought nothing of it until the next day when I got home and I said to my wife, I'm going to eat your pork chop for dinner. And she said, I already ate the pork chop for lunch. And I said, well, I'm staring at a pork chop in the refrigerator. So you didn't eat your pork chop for lunch. And of course, we realized that, they both ordered a pork chop and the pork chop came home with me. And my wife's and Teresa Strasser's pork chop came home with me and they took me deadly serious.
Oh my God.
About taking everyone's leftovers home with me. And
I'll be honest with you, you delivered it so well that I believed it too.
I thought part of being a good comedic actor is delivering it with sincerity and in an earnest tone. So maybe Grodin was just doing that with you, ironically, about going out to dinner.
Very possibly, but we ended up never going out to dinner, so I don't know.
Oh, it's the long game.
Yeah. Yes, yes. Who knows? Who knows what's coming around the corner?
You're going to get a phone call right after this podcast airs from one Charles Grodin, that much I'm sure of. So you've worked with De Niro quite a bit, or enough. Has De Niro changed? Was there a young sort of brash De Niro from Midnight Run, chip on his shoulder, tough guy De Niro to a now older, you know, more laid back De Niro? Or what's it like working with young De Niro and old De Niro?
I'll be honest, 100%. I didn't notice much of a difference, but he always, you know, I heard that he could be tough on other people. He never was with me. We always just really got along, you know. And I think, you know, I was always coming from a good place about the work, you know. And I think, I'm sure that in terms of a working relationship with somebody, he just wants to know that you really care about what you're doing. You know, he doesn't. You know, he was never like, if you made a mistake, if you screwed up or something, he's incredibly patient with that. I think if you didn't care or you weren't 100% on the ball with what you're doing, then I think he would react. But I really care about the work. So when we got along really famously, so I didn't see much of a difference. He literally has the energy of like 10 people. I mean, he would come on the set. He knew his lines. He knew Morgan's lines. He knew Tommy Lee Jones's lines. You know, he's very polite. Like, do you mind if I move here when I say this? Do you mind if I'm thinking to myself, you're Robert De Niro. You can stand on your head. You can do whatever the hell you want. You know, I'm just be happy to be making this movie with you, you know, but he's very collaborative. You know, we laughed a lot while we were making it. I mean, really had a good time.
Tommy Lee, what's he like?
Very, very interesting. Very, very quiet, very internalized, wants to rehearse over and over and over and over again. To him, it's like precision. And for De Niro is completely like, I don't need to rehearse. Let's just jump in and see what happens. So it was quite different to be with an actor who just wanted to keep experimenting and a person who was very, very I'm going to do this way, you know, almost like in a, I wouldn't say clinical, but certainly very studied. And he'd worked out everything that he was going to do, highly concentrated, you know, so that was interesting trying to juggle that, you know, but they obviously they knew each other's rhythms and they went with it, you know.
I don't want to seem like a racist. So what was it like working with Morgan Freeman real quick?
Morgan's an old friend. So, I mean, I've done three movies with Morgan.
Yeah, we got it. Gina.
And I'm about to do another movie with him.
I'm just being a dick. What movie are you doing with him in March?
I'm doing a movie called Mutie. It's a thriller.
Oh, really?
Yeah, Morgan and I are just buddies. So, like, it's easy. If I have something and he's right for it, I just call him up and we go make the film together. I've been making these movies independently. It's a lot more fun than doing them at a studio where everything's committees. I'm just done with that.
Well, Gina's got a question, but I got a quickie first.
Sure.
That may have a longer answer. But okay. I was doing a podcast earlier. I was talking to Justin Long, the actor, and we were talking about Matthew McConaughey, and we're trying to figure out, like, why do people love him so much? And we basically concluded that he's so comfortable in his own skin, and that all the greats, I guess when people talk about having it, it's a comfort level. It's like a sort of, they just seem so comfortable in their own skin. And Morgan Freeman seems insanely comfortable in his own skin. He just has that. And then the opposite is the person that's always tapping their foot and talking too loud and overcompensating and messing with their hair all the time or all their quirks. So he has that insane comfort level in his own skin. And would you say that, you know, you work with a lot of actors, but you only work with a handful of like mega, you know, actors, superstars. Does that seem to be a quality that you see in those guys?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, Morgan, I have to say, especially Morgan is just calm, centered. He really is the guy he is in the movies. He's very, very funny. And yeah, he's a very centered individual, you know. The first time, it's funny, like I did a movie with him a few years ago, and I'd never worked with him before. And, you know, I woke up in the morning, like you're supposed to be on the set at 6, you know, and I'm thinking to myself at 4 in the morning, like, how the hell am I going to direct Morgan Freeman? You're like, who am I to tell Morgan Freeman how to do so? You know, you go through all those things in your head. We get to the set. He's just the nicest guy in the world. You know, where do you want me to stand? What do you want me to do? I said, well, I want you to stand by the window and blah, blah, blah. And first take, he just nails it. I mean, he's Morgan Freeman. And he turns around, he goes, "Any?" You know, when I say cut, he goes, anything else? And I was like, actually, no. And then he goes, you and me are going to get along just fine. And, you know, after that, we've been, best buddies. So obviously we're 4 films in a row together now.
Gina?
Well, my thought when you said, you know, how different the styles are between Robert De Niro and Tommy Lee Jones at the time, I thought, well, who won out when they had scenes together? And that's something I'm curious about. But I also just wanted to mention those 3 actors in particular, Robert De Niro, Tommy Lee Jones, and Morgan Freeman. We've been watching a lot of Bugs Bunny here because we have a 5-year-old in the house, and
okay.
So much stuff that's, you know, for adults. It's very, we can't get enough. But you think about Mel Blanc, in a way, they're all sort of the acting equivalent of Mel Blanc, where they are the best at what they do. And for the most part, they do that thing. You know what I mean? Like they don't.
Of course.
It's magical to watch.
I am so happy that you know who Mel Blanc is.
I'm a big fan.
Yeah, but me too.
I am wondering who won out in those, you know, I want to rehearse all day, let's just go.
You know, in the end, we kind of just went. But Tommy and I would talk privately quite a bit about what we were going to do. And everyone was just very respectful of everyone else, you know. You couldn't ask for 3 guys more prepared. I mean, you know, they'd just show up and they would just nail it. And I would just be like in awe. I'm like, wow, these guys are making me look great, you know. I mean,
is the independent route for you obviously much easier when you're having the kind of relationships with A-listers that you have? much more difficult, I guess, if you're trying to kind of do things outside of the system and you don't have access to these people. Is that a correct statement?
Yeah, of course it is. You know, I mean, look, I've been around long enough. I've been doing this forever. So I have so many relationships. It's nice that I can just pick up a phone and call talent and put together a film, you know, which is what I've been doing the last four or five movies. That's how I've done them. And, you know, I don't need a bunch of, you know, people who don't know really how to make a film screwing it up. I could screw it up all by myself. I mean, if I'm going to make a mistake, I'd rather it be me that made it than I listened to somebody or got forced into a spot where I had it. You don't learn that way. You know, I just, every movie you make, hopefully you get better, you know, and I've been blessed in that. I just get to do them the way I want to do them, for better or for worse.
Well, a couple thoughts. One is, what art form is better by committee? You know, could you imagine if George Carlin sat down with 19 people and vetted his jokes with them, or Picasso, or anyone who sat down to write a symphony, or, you know, I mean, like, what form of art works with a whole bunch of people in the room all weighing in? So what should be different about this? Number one.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm sorry, Adam. Go ahead. Sorry.
No, address that, and then I'll tell you my second.
Even if you had four geniuses, five geniuses in a room, if you had Picasso, Monet, you know, John Constable and John Singer Sargent, you had four brilliant painters in a room, you're still not going to get a brilliant painting because they think so differently. So, no. I mean, what did Jimmy Breslin say? He said if a committee gets together to build a perfect racehorse, they end up with a donkey.
Right.
So.
Yeah. And also that sort of, we want the young demographic, we want the old demographic, we want straight and gay. I always say, imagine if you're making a car and the edict is we have to be all things to all people. You end up with a Pontiac Aztec. You know what I mean? You can't make a car that's going to suit everybody, you know? And I think that's the studio problem, is like, we want everybody to love this movie.
That's an impossibility, especially with a comedy, because sometimes, I mean, people, like, some people will laugh at something, other people will be offended by it. I mean, I guess this comeback trail is somewhat offensive in that it's got more of a 70s sensibility. It's got more of a kind of a Mel Brooks vibe to it, you know, because they're making a Western in the movie. And so it's got some of those 70s attitudes, you know, towards people, you know. I find funny, you know, I'm from the 70s.
I will compliment you in that, you know, ultimately the thing no one really teaches you about life is it's really all just about relationships. It's all about, does this person want to work with you again, you know? And being on a movie set is a little bit of a pressure cooker, and it sometimes brings out the worst in people, because anyone can be awesome to go out on a sightseeing cruise on a boat and have some drinks. You know what I mean? Everyone's sort of at their best, but the set of a movie is you're up against time, you're up against money. It kind of can bring out the worst. It's stressful in people. So the fact that all these people want to work with you over and over again is a testament to your, you know, bedside manner and your affability and your creativity. I mean, they have to respect you. These people can work with whoever they want to work with. But let's talk about that relationship, the fact that these people call you or you call them, they pick up the phone, they want to do another project with you. 'Cause I got to tell you, if you work with some bad director or bad producer or bad outfit or entity, which I have, you just go, fuck it. I'm not doing anything with those people ever again. Like, the first thing out of your mouth is, whatever it is they want to do, I don't want to do it with them.
Yeah. I didn't know you could curse on this show.
Go curse
anything
away.
You want.
I flinched when you said F-bomb. Yeah, I don't know. What's the question exactly?
It's more of a ass-kissy compliment statement, really.
No, look,
Carry on.
Carry on.
No. It's, you know, look, in the end, you know, it's probably the wrong thing to say. Look, it's an interview, and I'm always honest in these interviews. You know, it could even be the wrong thing to say, but I think, for like an investor to hear, you can't, what ends up driving you nuts when you're making a film is that you start thinking about too many other things during the process of making it, which is, Jesus, I hope this thing makes money. Jesus, I hope this. And oh my God, I hope that. Before you know it, you start driving yourself crazy. And if I've learned anything, I learned that, and this might even sound crazy in a way, but I believe it to be true. The movie, you can rehearse it and make it and hope it to be whatever you want it to be. But in the end, it almost if it's going to be really good, it has to become almost a byproduct of you having a good time with some people. Because if you're having a miserable fucking time, you're going to make a miserable fucking movie.
Watch the language, George, but keep going.
Yeah. And it's going to end up on the screen. You know what I'm saying? So you have to have fun. So if we're having fun, it's not like there's 100 people on a set and suddenly, you know, only they think it's funny. If you're having a good time and you're laughing and, hey, what do you think? And you turn it into this communal thing, it has to succeed. It has to work. But if you start getting into all those other thoughts, you're kind of dead. You get weighted down by them. So I've just eliminated all that from my thinking.
Well, let me give the movie a plug, although we don't have a hard release date. The Comeback Trail. We can see a website, thecomebacktrail.com. You should go there and watch a very funny trailer. De Niro and Tommy Lee Jones, Morgan Freeman, Emile Hirsch, and amongst a cavalcade of very interesting, recognizable celebrities. It'll be sometime in 2021. George, we hope when it hits the theaters, you'll come back on with us and we can talk it up again.
And we have a mutual friend, Nate. Our dear friend Nate, you know.
Oh yeah, I make documentaries with Nate.
Yeah. He put us together. So Nate's a great guy. I love him.
I love Nate too, and I like working with Nate as well because he's real nuts and bolts guy. Well, he has a combination of strong creativity with a kind of homespun Montana, ice fishing kind of Americana sensibility, which is nice. They're not normally things you find under one roof in terms of a human being.
No, he's a good guy, and he really cares about what he's doing. My mother-in-law is from Montana,
And you make documentaries as well, right?
Yes, I've made a few.
Maybe we'll collaborate on something.
I would love that. I would absolutely love that. Can I ask one last question about the guitar in the background? What kind of guitar is that?
Oh, for me?
Yes.
Oh, we have a couple of cheap, we have a couple Fenders back here that we just noodle around on. Nothing special.
I'm a guitar player, so I was just curious.
We have one lefty and one righty back there.
Okay, so one for Paul McCartney, one for John Lennon.
That's right. I'm Paul McCartney.
Are you? Okay. Are you? I'm left-handed, but I play righty.
I wasn't allowed to. My brother said, we're lefties and we play lefties. So that's all I get to do.
Okay. Well, I'm a lefty. And then my father taught me golf right-handed too. No. You'll never get a set of clubs.
So. Right.
Well, that was my question. Can you get a guitar? I mean, famously, Jimi Hendrix just took a right-handed guitar and just strung it different and played it left-handed. Because you couldn't get them. Well, I was left-handed when I was a kid, and I still am, and I'd go out and try to find a baseball mitt, and there were like 5,000 offerings for right-handers and two for left-handers. But there must be more now. Like you can get when I started in carpentry, I couldn't get a left-handed circular saw. Now they have left-hand. They've somehow come around on left-handers.
I think there's more of us.
There's more.
Sitting in high school desks was always fun.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, God. It was like twisting yourself into a pretzel just to try and find. That's why lefties always have lead.
Yeah, all the ink. The ink and the lead.
That's right.
You know, next time I talk to a gay man and he tells me about the struggles of trying to be converted to heterosexuality, I'll go, I played Pop Warner football and had to be in a right-handed football stance. And I'm a lefty, so I feel your pain, bro.
We're simpatico.
I wouldn't say my situation is worse, but it could be argued. Yeah. George Gallo, yes. The Comeback Trail, thank you very much for joining us, my friend.
Thank you so much. I had a lot of fun. Thanks, guys.
And come by the office. Say hi to Nate and look at some Paul Newman race cars.
I actually saw it. I saw the car. It's great, but I'll definitely come by.
All right, George, thank you very much.
Thank you.
All right, quick break. We'll come back with Gina and the news right after this.
Give me the news with Grad. News with Gina Grad. Breaking viral. All those crazy Trump tweets. Give me news with Gina Grad. Trouble in the Middle East. Celebrity drunk meltdowns. Give news with Gina. Gina Grad.
The news with Gina Grad.
Another notable death occurred over the weekend. Phil Spector, the music producer, is credited for inventing the wall of sound method and who later was convicted of murder. He died at 81. California state prison officials say he died Saturday of natural causes at a hospital. He was convicted of murdering actress Lana Clarkson in 2003 at his castle-like mansion on the edge of LA. After a trial in 2009, he was sentenced to 19 years to life. Meanwhile, as a side note, the BBC News website has apologized for their headline reporting on Spector's death. It first initially said, "Talented but flawed producer Phil Spector dies at 81. Then they apologized and said that did not meet their editorial standards and changed it to pop producer jailed for murder dies at 81.
I saw the fallout from the several headlines that failed to capture the totality of his life. I tweeted this. I don't know if it's worth crisping fines or not, but I tweeted that this observation that I had that Phil Spector presents a really unique challenge for headline writers, especially like how do you encapsulate this man's life in one sentence? At one time, he was one of the most influential figures in all of pop music history. On the other hand, he's a convicted murderer. Like when it comes to OJ or Bill Cosby or any number of, you know, infamous people who are going to pass away in the next few years, this is going to be another bridge to cross.
Yeah, I never did. I should ask Garagus about that because, you know, Phil, first off, brilliant guy, brought so much great music. And for anyone who loves George Harrison, like I do, really brought so much to the table and so many other artists. But the murder thing always felt weird to me in that he like brought her home. He brought the gun out. He was like showing off with the gun or something. But I don't think they ever nailed him as the trigger person. I don't think they proved that he like put the gun in her mouth and shot her. I don't know.
I was under the impression he was convicted of murder.
He was.
That's wrong. I take it back.
He was convicted. No, he was convicted of murder, okay. But I don't know that the evidence was there that he literally squeezed the trigger. And it seemed like the case was more nuanced. I was surprised that he got murder. I thought it would have been involuntary manslaughter or some maybe even murder two or something. It also didn't seem premeditated at all. Like he went out to Dan Tana's, ordered a Shirley cocktail, left a $600 tip or something insane. I mean, he literally ordered a drink at, I think it was Dan Tana's or someplace like that on Sunset Strip.
It had to be Dan Tana's.
He had to be at Dan Tana's, left a $500 or $600 tip on a, you know, $11 bar tab, met this chick. I think she worked at House of Blues, or maybe he went down to House of Blues and then met her at House of Blues. He's a pervy old dude who like picked up a hot young blonde, took her back to his estate, did what he did. He did a lot of gunplay stuff. He did a lot of showing off. There's a bunch of stories of him, you know, in the studio with either George Harris, I think John Lennon, maybe the Beatles, and like pulling a gun out and waving it around. But he didn't meet her to take her home and kill her. Like, I don't think they had any history or anything. He probably wanted to bang her back at his place, but he probably did that thing where he pulled the gun out and was showing off with the gun. But doesn't that get you down to manslaughter or something?
Well, yes. Let me address that because I'm looking at it right here. First of all, like you said, he told Esquire magazine in 2003 that Clarkson's death was an accidental suicide and that she, quote unquote, kissed the gun. So he, you know, God knows what kind of weird shit he was doing there. But it does say Spector was tried for murder of Clarkson in 2007. That was declared a mistrial due to a hung jury. And he was tried again for second degree murder in 2008. And that's what they got him on. Mm. So like you said, second degree murder.
I wonder if he pulled the trigger. I guess he did.
It was Dan Tanna's. And of course. $500 tip on a $55 tab.
Well, you know, the waitresses all must have collectively shed a tear when he was incarcerated, right?
Yeah, I'm looking at the quote. Where to go? Dan Tanna himself. Yeah, he was always very generous with the help, unquote, said Dan Tanna.
Yeah, well, I'd say tipping 7,000%, not too shabby. Did he then go to House of Blues and meet her, or did she work at House of Blues?
She worked at a part-time House of Blues.
And did she meet him at Dan Tanna's? Anyway, it didn't seem very premeditated, but I think I kind of get the feeling with Phil that there were so many stories of him waving around a gun where nobody got hurt, but he'd fire it into the ceiling of the recording studio or threaten somebody. But it was just all these kind of tales from the past. I felt like this was a little payback. Like, you cannot spend your entire career waving a gun around, and now you need second degree versus manslaughter or whatever. Right. Yes.
Chris might have found the same story I found, but according to the story that ran in the LA Times and Chicago Tribune, Spector is known to have visited the House of Blues, the Sunset Strip Club where Clarkson worked as a hostess. Employees saw her leave with him in a chauffeur-driven black Mercedes S430. So nice. When her shift ended at about 2:30 a.m. But it is not clear whether Spector had been at the club early in the evening when three metal bands were playing.
Mm.
So he was there. She left the club with him. Right. Unclear if he had been there.
He must have hated metal bands. Their arrangements
and
production.
That was his speed. Yeah.
All right. Well, he'll be missed.
By some, yeah. By some. So let's move on to Twitter Corner. Have a couple of Twitter stories. So Alec Baldwin is taking himself off Twitter, according to CNN. He announced that he's out Monday in the wake of the uproar over his wife's claim of having Spanish heritage. The tweet says, "Twitter's like a party where everyone is screaming. Not much of a party. Goodbye for now." So just to reset, Hilaria Baldwin, a.k.a. Hillary Hayward Thomas, I believe, faced backlash after an online social media began accusing her of faking a Spanish accent and questioning where she was born. She's, not born on the island of Mallorca, but in Boston. Videos of her speaking with an accent appeared on social media. People who claim to have attended high school with her also posted to dispute her claim. Baldwin has defended her, saying, "There's things that have been said lately about people I love that I care deeply about, which are ridiculous. I'm just ridiculous." But remember, she is the one that was on, I don't know if it was the Today Show, where she's doing a cooking segment and can't remember the English word for cucumber.
How you say?
Yes, how you say cucumber, so, right?
He's over
or just
it.
How you say.
No, how do you say it in English?
In English, right.
You know what Baldwin said to everyone?
Quiet.
Yep. Now he's going to be quiet on Twitter. How's he going to know when to phone into the show if he's off Twitter, though, Max Pata?
Yeah, we're going to have to figure that one out.
His burner accounts.
That's right. All right. What else we got,
again,
Gina?
I love him for standing by his woman, and I'm not being sarcastic. I think that is a true love story, the way he has come to her aid.
Does he speak Spanish? I mean, can they communicate?
That's a good question.
Mm.
I mean, the language of love.
All right.
Yeah. Another Twitter story, actress Christy Swanson wants to be canceled, and she wants to be canceled to support President Trump. So let me explain this.
She accomplished that 25 years ago.
Well, she wants to get in the time machine and be canceled. Let me explain. Last week, fans called for Trump to be digitally removed from Home Alone 2, Lost in New York. And over the weekend, she tweeted because she was
Wait, who wants Trump to be digitally removed?
Trump taken out of Home Alone 2.
Wow.
Over the weekend. Yeah.
This is scary and kind of Orwellian. Like tearing down statues is one thing.
Right.
But that's digitally. Physical, but digitally removed. Ooh, that's interesting.
I agree.
Yeah, I agree. The statue thing is like you're honoring this racist or whatever. But like he was in a movie. Like, what's the next? We're taking OJ out of Naked Gun? You take Nordberg out of Naked Gun?
Nordberg. So she's kind of calling the bluff in some ways, says if cancel culture is really going to have Donald Trump removed from the John Hughes movie, then in support of my president, I'd like to have myself officially removed from the John Hughes films Pretty in Pink and Ferris Bueller's Day Off. Now, if you don't remember, Pretty in Pink, she's at the very end. I think she's credited as like Miss Ducky because she's the one that John Cryer sees at the end and like she gives him a little wave and then the credits roll. In Ferris Bueller's Day Off, I think she's the one that does the speech about where Ferris is, like my sister's boyfriend's cousins, you know, saw him faint at 31 Flavors. I heard it's pretty serious. That's Christy Swanson.
Oh, really?
So she wants both of those clips removed. Of course, Twitter is just beating the shit out of her for this. You were in that. Who are you? Who cares? But, you know, she makes a point.
She kept her Mustang in my warehouse for 6 months. I had
where you are right now?
No, I have multiple warehouses.
That's why I asked.
Yeah, I wish I could remember the street name and the address, but there's
you're
so
the
many.
Trump of Glendale with all that real estate.
Right. Yeah, I don't know how it got to me, but
Tower.
She's needed a place to keep her Mustang. I had no idea how hardcore she was. She is hard goddamn core, man.
Her Twitter bio is like I'm not quoting, but it's like proud mom, God first, you know, very religious. I only know her secondhand. My dear friend Lindsay Parker, who was in the movie Flowers in the Attic with her when they were, you know, when she was a baby. I mean, how old is that movie? Remember from the mid-80s?
Mm-hmm.
She worked with Christy Swanson, who played her sister, and said she was lovely.
She was nice to me. But usually when people are asking for you to store their classic car for 9 months for free, they're not super bitchy when they drop it off.
They don't go full Grodin on you.
Yeah. No. Soft sell.
It's a Grodin. Does any of Grodin's clips exist on the internet and him on that TV show?
I think there's one of him interviewing Letterman, but we're trying to find yours. Gio's looking now. He was on the road. When
even Letterman would be interesting just to see his style, which is bizarre.
God. Can you imagine the pulse rate in that interview?
Yes.
Yeah, two very sarcastic, dry.
What'd you have? Sorry, Brian.
I was going to say, do you envision, maybe this is a bit of a made-up movie, or perhaps we're living in this made-up movie, is there a world where, because you know, the joke now is, you know, between Scott Baio and, you know, Kevin Sorbo and Christy Swanson, and these actors and actresses have seen better days, the ones who maybe support, but when I say better days, they were more popular in another era, yet they support, you know, President Trump very loudly, and they're in the public eye as a result of it. Is there a sort of world where someone who just doesn't give a shit about politics embraces, you know, the MAGA lifestyle just to get, you know, an actor who has not been in the public eye for many decades just to get back in? You know what I mean? Just to be discussed.
Black Mirror and interesting, yeah.
And it's also a bit of a made-up movie, Simpsons episode. You know what I mean? Like, James Woods, love that guy. I enjoy him as an actor very much, but his best days are clearly behind him as an actor.
Well, I guess at a certain point, if this is your... So if your wish is to be recognized and heard and discussed and in sort of the public eye, at a certain point when it comes to Trump or most also probably a lot of just general right wing, you know, as far as like a hard right stance on subjects. If the conceit is, if you want to operate in Hollywood and you take a hard right stance or a Trump stance, and it's definitely going to damage your career, then you have to figure out, I guess, where your career is. Mm-hmm. And then there's a kind of a, it, provided this is what you're thinking. I mean, obviously, it could just all be authentic. They could just love Trump or be hard right.
That's more likely, of course.
Or whatever it is. But if there was this person, this actor, and you're thinking, I got to be photographed wearing the MAGA hat, I got to go to the rally and blah, 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 then you wouldn't definitely do it when your career was going gangbusters, because you're going to pull the old, you're going to pull the carpet out from under yourself. And you wouldn't do it if it was going okay and you were still struggling and working and trying to get jobs and had some irons in the fire. You would do it when there was nothing going on and now your choice is zero versus showing up on Sean Hannity five times a year and being destroyed on Twitter. So if you're cynical, I guess you could go, well, that's where those people were. But different versions of it feel more sincere. Like Kevin Sorbo feels, or like Dean Cain. Dean Cain right. feels wildly authentic to me.
I agree.
But there's probably a few out there that are sort of it's sort of like the serial killer who wishes he made the newspaper for being in a successful rock and roll band, but he's still going to be goddamned if he's not in that newspaper.
They're going to know my
Manson.
Name.
That's Charles Manson.
We got
Manson.
Right. We got Charles Grodin back and forth with Don Rickles from the Charles Grodin talk show.
I'm already uncomfortable.
I've never even brought up doing the Charles Grodin show, right?
I didn't know that.
A bizarre old memory from 1997 for me. All right, let's see.
Joining me now is comedian Don Rickles. He will be at Carnegie Hall in New York City on June 12th. He is in our Burbank studio. You will be at Carnegie Hall. Are you going to see someone? I mean, what are you going to be doing at Carnegie Hall? I mean, as part of an introduction to say we're some, I guess you'll be at the Carnegie Delicatessen as well. Is that right?
I had thought it would be, hi, Don, how are you?
Oh,
I mean, well, I mean, you know, how's your family? Or, gee, it's nice of you to be on the show.
Well, you know, let me start with that.
I had no idea you were going to hit me with Carnegie Deli.
Now, wait a minute. You're absolutely right. Let me begin again.
You're a big star now.
How is your family?
Not well. My uncle was hit by a truck, and my mother's very ill. But don't you worry about it.
Is that right?
You just have a good show.
You know, well, one of the things that I noticed in the longer intro of you, we worked on this intro to cut it down because I wanted time for us to talk. It said that you're a paid spokesperson for this Toyota Comedy Festival. Would you be a spokesperson? No, for the Comedy Channel. Is that right?
No, for the Comedy Channel, Chuck. You got it right. First of all, let me just say it's nice.
This is great comedy.
Is there more to this?
Sorry, we were supposed to cut it earlier than that.
Oh, okay. You see his super dry kind of weird, like where he would go, you know, Adam Carolla, and they say you're a comedian, but I haven't seen your show. Like, that was his style.
Right. And he was Jiminy Glick without the wink.
Yes.
Right.
Now you can't take it personally.
A super dry Jiminy Glick. But by the way, Letterman would do the same thing. Tell me you do a late night show. I mean, I did the second time I did Letterman, I literally called him out on it. Like, he did the I haven't seen the show and I don't know what this other thing is, and I was like, I called him out on it. I was like, don't you have producers or segment producers or some version of that? But it's like, he would do that I don't know what you do kind of, I mean, he wouldn't say I don't know what you do, he'd say you're playfully on a show that I've never seen, basically.
Is he playfully big timing you, or you think there's?
I think it was a bit of a shtick, right?
Yeah.
Because Letterman did that a lot in his early days. Well,
yeah.
He did it the whole way through. I don't know, but when I watched him, he would do it a lot.
Yeah, it was the same kind of thing. If you can find any more Grodin, it's going to make me laugh because I wasn't the only person that felt that way. Because in real time, when you're being interviewed, you're like, why is this person being a douche to me when? maybe we'll find it, but yes, him talking to, well, how about him and Letterman?
I thought it was because if you Google Charles Grodin, it says Charles Grodin interviews David Letterman, so I thought
it was on Letterman.
It was on
right.
Letterman, yeah.
All right, well, if you can find another one, it's going to make me laugh. Grodin, man. That guy
was fun. That's funny.
He's funny, right? But I don't know.
Do you guys remember, and I'm going in the Wayback Machine for this. This is, again, another baby Gina childhood movie that I loved throughout the mid-80s. Do you remember Charles Grodin and Lily Tomlin in The Incredible Shrinking Woman?
Yes.
You've seen it, I imagine.
I never saw it.
It might have been the only movie playing in North Hollywood in 1982.
I'm trying to think if I probably did see it. That was one. There was one of, remember all those 80s house movies where like Jim Belushi's The Pool Man for a Rich Guy and the French door's left open. So he stumbles in and then
opportunity knocks with right. Dan Carvey.
And then right. the phone rings and he picks up the phone and they're like, the Hanson deal's in full effect. We need you down here right now. And then he finds the guy's wallet. And the next thing you know, he's living in his house and he's fucking his wife. And the other guy's out on the street. Like they should do a lot of that. Like, once you get into someone's house, you're in it, man.
Well, you live there. That's your life.
Yeah. He Belushi did the same thing in Curly Sue.
There was, I think, Grodin and Belushi starred in one of those movies where he took over that guy's life. It seems hard to sustain for 100 minutes. You know what I mean? Yeah. Like it's some
that it is.
Yes, it is. You're right.
You're not good movies.
You're absolutely right. What is, if you could find the movie poster for Charles Grodin, Jim Belushi movie, it'll probably make us all laugh. All right, what else we got, Gina Grad? Jerry Springer's coming on tomorrow, by the way.
All right.
Very excited about that. He hasn't been on a long time. Remember his harrowing story about the Holocaust?
Mm-hmm.
That was incredible. I still remember it. I get chills. I just got a breaking news alert. I will read it to you right now. Breaking another Dodgers legend lost. MLB legend Don Sutton, dead at 75, passed away in his sleep. Not sure if you're familiar with him or his career.
Don Sutton had one of the few blonde perms.
That's what he's remembered for.
That's what I remember him for. Dodger great with the blonde perm. He had a blonde perm. And most of the blonde guys never went with the perm because they're like, fuck it, I got blonde hair. I don't got to do anything. I'll just let it hang down. It was always the Brady boys that were going with the perm. But Don Sutton, in his pitching prime, had a perm. He was only 72?
Five.
75? Yes. Young, because it seemed like he pitched for the Dodgers so goddamn long ago. He was, he was a Dodger great. No doubt about it. So, if you're Oral Hershiser, you better be worried because this shit happens in threes, right?
Fernando Valenzuela's quaking in his boots.
He's probably got a few comorbidities, if I know Fernando.
I remember the mid to late 80s, because of soccer, all the boys who had mullets in Kansas got the back of their hair permed.
Oh, boy.
Remember that?
No.
Or that was just a Kansas thing?
We grew up in civilization.
Yeah.
Jesus Christ. Woo!
Yeah. Ooh, boy.
Wow.
We can afford barbers.
Yeah.
Oh, we could afford formaldehyde and whatever else goes into a perm.
Yeah, you can find a picture of him with a full blonde perm. He's quite a perm. And Fernando Valenzuela, famously, when he pitched, would roll his eyes up and look at the bill of his cap and just roll it. That's just what he did.
That was his thing. When he in his windup, he would like look towards heaven. I don't know what that was.
That is crazy, right?
Or who's more superstitious than baseball players?
I know. It's insane that was part of his technique to roll his eyes. Maybe he was super judgmental and condescending in his native.
Oh, this fucking batter.
Yeah. Ugh. I don't know why I bother pitching this guy, but okay.
They're going to make me throw the ball.
Yeah.
They just call him out now.
Has anyone in the history of pitching ever done that? I mean, he was wildly successful. There was Fernando mania and everything in Los Angeles, but he rolled his eyes all the way up when he...
familiar with another player.
Right before he threw the ball. Don Sutton, he shall... I didn't... I guess at the time he would do some like local car dealership commercials, and he probably got up into the booth at some point.
He did broadcasting, right?
Yeah.
Did he do the Braves games on TNT or TBS? Or am I fucking totally insane?
I don't know. I don't know enough about baseball, but I definitely remember Don Sutton. But again, it was his blonde perm that I remember the most.
Brian's right about the Braves.
Well, that's like you.
The Braves, yes.
Yeah, it's for like a year, because the Braves were televised nationally on TBS. It was Atlanta, you know, mm-hmm. It was Ted Turner, all that.
Right.
And he's the Braves. I always associated him with the Braves. He's a Dodger legend. I always associated him with the Braves as a kid.
It's like you said about porn stars doing real estate. All athletes go to used car sales.
Yes.
Car dealerships.
Yeah, they do that when they're playing, and sometimes right after they're playing as well. All right, Gina, let's bring it home.
You got it. I'm Gina Grad, and that's the news. Gina
Grad! That was the news with Gina Grad.
Hey, movie lovers, who needs a theater when you have Pluto TV? Grab your popcorn and your streaming device because free movies are here. Pluto TV is your home for movies. Great movies are playing anytime in over 20 exclusive movie channels of action, horror, rom-coms, and more. Watch hits like Saving Private Ryan, Pretty in Pink, and Charlie's Angels all for free. No signups, no fees, no contracts. Ever. Download the free Pluto TV app on any device.